Tottenham story is this. It's time to change the situation if Tottenham want to change.
I love to win, mate. That's the main thing. Hopefully I can fulfil those dreams and aspirations of every Tottenham supporter.
And still Ricky Villa. What a fantastic run. He scored.
He's going to have a crack. He is, you know.
I'm loving big engines. Guess I'm a Spurs fan now then.
Well, hello everybody. Welcome to our latest edition of the Tottenham Way. We're all still basking in the reflected glory of the North London Derby on Sunday. Although, I've got to say, the more I think about it now, the more I wish we'd won. The more I feel perhaps we should have won, which has to be a positive, bearing in mind the way most of us were feeling beforehand. Although, hats off to Dan Kilpatrick. And me, for predicting a draw. The pessimist, Mr. Allnut of the Times, absolutely wrong, saying that Spurs would lose. Mr. Barkley of the Sun, well, we admired his optimism beforehand, saying that Spurs would win. And, well, Richarlison had that chance. Boys, what more can we say? I very much enjoyed your reactionary podcast straight after the game. I think the fact that there's a little bit of frustration that Spurs didn't pick up all 3 points reflects... Damn, what a brilliant start we have made under Big Ange.
Yeah, I mean, I think the guys covered it really well on the Reaction podcast. I don't have a huge amount more to add on the game that they didn't cover. But I do think in the days since, now the dust has settled, there is a kind of prevailing feeling among Spurs fans, at least from ones I've seen on social media, that maybe it was an opportunity slightly missed and that Spurs could have, you know, gone for it against an Arsenal side who were obviously missing Rice in the second half and were perhaps a bit more for there for the taking than Spurs realised. But I think that's probably getting ahead of ourselves a little bit. I think a point in the circumstances against them is a very, very good point and a very encouraging one. Before the game, I wasn't sure still what we could expect from Postecoglou Spurs this season. You know, I was very optimistic about the medium to long-term future, but given the opponents in the first five matches, you know, even United, which was a very open game and could have gone either way in the first half. I think given who Spurs had kind of played and beaten already, I still wanted to see where they were against a top team. And I think we've now seen that. We'll obviously learn more after the Liverpool game. But I think, you know, Spurs showed that they're a proper side on Sunday and they can match, you know, they will match, you know, provided their first 11 is fit. You know, any team in the country this season, they'll take the game to them. And most encouraging was, you know, as Postecoglou has said and as the guys said, was the fact that they just played the manager's way. You know, it was a complete and total commitment to playing out from the back. It was a commitment to playing, passing football through the lines. They resisted the temptation to kind of panic and boot it long. And just kind of finally listening to all the players do their post-match interviews, there's a real tangible sense, I think, that everyone's kind of fully bought in, that they're kind of speaking with the zeal of the converts. I think the players, you know, they've really bought into Pochettino, slip of the tongue, Postecoglou's methods. And you know, we spoke to Van de Ven, Son and Vicario after the game, and it was really striking kind of how enthused and committed they all are. And I think there's a real sense that something's building now at Spurs.
Yeah, I mean, the one thing that was scary on Sunday was that moment when we all, I think, feared that Maddison had done something. And that's what worries me between now and Christmas. I know I'm going to sound like an absolute hypocrite here because I was so furious when we got knocked out of the League Cup. And then there's a part of me going, oh, thank God we're not playing in the League Cup this week because we can rest everybody up, hopefully get Maddison fit. I'm not sure what the Johnson situation's going to be, but clearly, if something happens to him in particular already, boys, I mean, his influence is extraordinary, you know, involved in both the goals on Sunday. And, you know, Lo Celso is working to get fit in the background. But I think, Tom, may it be fair to say already that I think Maddison's irreplaceable at this stage.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I guess it's that thing we were speaking about in the summer where we said that, yes, Spurs is... signings have been, you know, encouraging, but they have taken a risk. When we were talking maybe specifically there about the defenders, but it is also the case with someone like Maddison, you know, that they are relying on him. And he's, but I also think it's partly because of how well he's played. You know, in, it's not just that they don't have, you know, a like for like replacement. It's also because he is playing so well, it feels very difficult to find someone who will do as good a job as he has done, you know, just as it was like that with someone like Harry Kane, or it would be if it was, you know, Son as well. I mean, the news, I think, is that, you know, he's having a scan and we wait to see. I mean, I guess it was, you know, vaguely encouraging that he was able to play on for at least a while. But, you know, we await further news. But it would be a huge blow, you know, if he was out for any period of time. I mean, I do think on a separate point, just in the last two or three days since that game, and, you know, the dust has kind of settled, there's been a slight kind of narrative developing in certain corners that maybe, you know, Arsenal had injuries, that they weren't at their best, that they had Rice, you know, going off at halftime. You know, was this, you know, an opportunity for Tottenham that they really should have taken, rather than the kind of the emphasis being that there was an opportunity, but they played really well and actually it was still a good result. And I sort of almost fundamentally kind of reject that. I just think that Spurs played really well, and yes, Arsenal had injuries, but let's not forget Spurs also have injuries. And bottom line is, you know, if we're talking about kind of mitigating circumstances here, Tottenham are the new team. You know, they're the ones who had loads of young players coming into this derby match who had never played in the North London derby before. A load of new players kind of still adjusting to the Premier League. You know, I don't think this was a game where Arsenal were there for the taking and on the ropes and Tottenham, you know, missed an opportunity. And I just sort of seen that in the last couple of days. I wonder if it's kind of like one of those things where there's almost a kind of established narrative where Spurs played well, Postecoglou's on the up, and people kind of feel like they have to sort of say something a bit different. Just on that, I mean, I do think it's worth kind of saying that it felt like last week there was a real love in for Postecoglou. I mean, I think it was a big game, and Postecoglou is obviously a kind of new story for the media to kind of get their teeth into. And I wouldn't be surprised if there is a little bit of kickback in the next, you know, few weeks from some people in the media or fans, you know, because people do kind of get tired of this, or they like to kind of present the other side of the argument. And I wonder if Spurs kind of, you know, if they have a couple of dodgy results, people will say, oh, you know, people are getting carried away and Postecoglou's, you know, not the saviour that everyone says he was, et cetera, et cetera. So just, you know, the need for balance, I think.
Yeah, I mean, that's inevitable. There will be that sort of a reaction. But no, you're right. Look at that Spurs 11 that started on Sunday. Only two of those players were involved in the corresponding fixture less than a year ago. And if Arsenal are moaning about injuries, let's also point out that their goals were a deflected own goal and a penalty, which, okay, probably was a penalty, Tom B, but unless he cut his arm off, I'm not quite sure what else Romero was meant to do in the circumstances. So they got the rub of the green as well, didn't they?
Yes, although they really should have taken their chance, shouldn't they, when Maddison had his pocket pick by Jesus, and at 2-0, it would have been a real challenge for Spurs to get back from that point. But as I said on the reaction pod, I felt like as the game wore on, Arsenal were running out of ideas, and if one team was going to win it, it was probably going to be Tottenham. But just back to James Maddison, I mean, we heard in the summer after he signed how Postecoglou convinced him very quickly to join them. And he did have a great option in Newcastle as well that he could have gone to. And I think the more we watch him under Postecoglou, the more you think he's made the right decision. I just don't think Eddie Howe, as good a manager as he is, the way he plays would have really suited Maddison. He's quite a unique player, but a bit of a rarity that I really feel like he needs the right manager to get the best out of him. Just like we were saying with Yves Bissouma and Postecoglou, and how Conte was completely the wrong kind of manager last season for him. I just think Maddison, all his creative instincts, all his bravery on the ball, and his, as I say, instinct to want to try and make things happen, to dribble around players, to hold on to the ball, to spot passes. There aren't loads of managers out there that would really encourage that. It is changing a bit. You know, I could see him faring very well under De Zerbi at Brighton, and there are some other managers too, but sometimes in football, there are some positions that it kind of goes in cycles. You think of someone like Michael Owen, was excellent, obviously at the start of his career. But as it went on, obviously he had injuries. But that kind of quick, smaller striker didn't really have as many chances because teams started playing with just one up front. The number 10 position in recent years seems to have faded away a little bit. So the fact that it's sort of coming back, albeit in a slightly number 8 position at Spurs, is great news for Maddison, because a few years ago you would have thought, I don't quite know where he fits in most teams. But Postecoglou, fair play to him, he sold him his vision at Tottenham, and I don't think he could have picked a better option.
And talking of Maddison, and this is something, Dan, I know that you were particularly interested in after the game, his comments. Well, the comment I love was the little dig at Bukayo Saka and his darts celebration. And as Maddison said afterwards, I think he was still doing that when I picked his pocket for the first equaliser. But he also spoke about Spurs moving away from that Spursy reputation that's been, you know, so I think it drives us all mad, but there has been a degree of truth about it. Bit too early to say that, or are there genuine signs, Dan, do you feel that we are becoming less Spursy?
I think there are genuine signs that Spurs are building a really competitive top team, and it's great that the players feel, again, that they're, you know, part of something that's really going places, and they're part of changing the club. I think that's really encouraging. I mean, it's a good line, Maddison saying, you know, Spurs are moving away from being Spursy, and it is great for us as journalists. You know, it makes the back pages and it's eye-catching, but I don't set too much store by this kind of stuff. I think, you know, players often say this. I'm sure when Spurs were coming up under Conte in the back half of his first season, there would have been players saying, you know, we're developing a new mentality and we're kind of changing the club. Even under Mourinho, I'm sure there were players saying that. Certainly under Pochettino, a big theme was this sense that it was a new Spurs, a kind of hardier Spurs, a steelier Spurs who are going to win stuff and you know, shed that Spursy tag. So this does come around in cycles, that this kind of chat. But you know, I don't think it's ever a bad thing. And again, it kind of reflects the sense that within the dressing room, you know, within the camp, you know, they feel kind of excited as about this project as supporters do. And I think that's great. It really helps supporters buy into it when they feel like they sense and know that the players are kind of as enthused as they are and enjoying playing for the club as much as they're enjoying watching them. So I think it's all positive stuff. But yeah, personally, I don't kind of think it's a sort of revelatory comment that changes much.
But also, I mean, what is this Spursy thing? You know, I guess it's sort of not winning trophies, finding a way to kind of lose even when you should win. I don't know, sort of a tendency for kind of disaster, right? But it's essentially a very kind of abstract thing that's kind of, you know, caught on for the last few years. And I sort of think that by kind of saying we're not Spursy anymore, that is kind of half of the battle. Like, because we're not talking here about a technical problem. It's not something you can solve on the training ground. It is a mentality thing. It's something that just kind of exists in the above the Tottenham training ground. But if the players kind of come out and say it's not a thing anymore, you know, this team is a new team, we have a new mindset, we feel like we you know, have a different identity, then in my opinion, that's kind of half the battle, you know. And people will criticize Maddison and say, look, it's only six games and, you know, Spurs have achieved nothing yet. And that is true. But I guess what I'm trying to say is part of the way to kind of solve this thing is to kind of talk about it and say, we're brave enough to say that actually we're a different team now. We're stronger. We're more resilient. There's a new feeling in the squad. So I kind of commend Maddison for it. One thing I will say about Maddison is he will at one point get into trouble here, because, you know, he talks so much and he talks so well. And I guess even kind of linking to that on the pitch, you know, he's so expressive and kind of gets involved in arguments and he enjoys riling up the opposition fans. You know, I mean, he very pointedly kind of spent a long time applauding the Spurs fans when he went off. I think, you know, he was really enjoying kind of wasting it for some extra time. And at some point he'll come unstuck, you know, whether it's in the press or whether it's a red card in a match, you know, but that's just kind of par and parcel. I think we all have to accept that Maddison isn't Harry Kane. You know, he's not going to say the right thing and do the right thing all the time. And I fully expect at some point in his Tottenham career for something to come back in his face. But I think this was, you know, I don't think he was out of line or particularly, you know, presumptuous by saying this.
Well, to be fair, in that week, I think on the Friday, there were some pretty interesting stats that came out, which do kind of back up this narrative. In the Premier League era, Spurs had thrown away more points from winning positions than any other club with 451. Now, the caveat to that is obviously they've been in the Premier League the whole time compared to many other clubs. But still, it was quite eye-opening to see it sort of laid bare in that way. 451 points, as I said. Everton, I think, were next worst with 449, then Chelsea on about 5 points back after that. So it isn't completely without merit. The only other thing to say on that also is that Tottenham had also won more points from losing positions in those statistics. So I guess whatever you take from it, it's always going to be entertaining. And that certainly is the case right now under Postecoglou.
Yeah, well, there are stats and damn lies, and you can use them to whatever degree you want to. But listen, I agree with Tommy. Madison's occasionally going to say things that perhaps he shouldn't, but I don't care because he's bought into the club in exactly the same way I feel that Postecoglou has. They just fit perfectly, and everybody is flourishing all around them, including Yves Bissouma, who, you know, I've described him as a colossus every single week, and I thought he was absolutely magnificent at Arsenal on Sunday. And Tom A, you actually sat down and had a chat with him, and I was really interested to just discover a little bit about his personality. I've never, to my memory, seen him do an interview before, and I always thought he'd be quite a shy, quiet guy. You were telling me before we went on to do this podcast that actually that's not the case at all.
He's sort of relaxed and I don't know how to say it really. Like he's sort of the opposite of intense, like, you know, very kind of kick back. He was sort of, when I walked into we did it kind of in one of the offices at the top of the training ground, and he was just on the phone, like talking in French, I think it was, to one of his mates seemingly. And, you know, he carried on that conversation for a few minutes whilst we were kind of waiting to get going. And then initially, like, he was kind of struggling to sort of speak English. I think it's that thing where he had to really sort of switch his brain into English mode, but then, you know, he was completely fine. Yeah, very sort of smiley, cheery kind of guy with some really nice stories to tell and a very interesting background as well. I mean, you know, was born in Ivory Coast, but moved to Mali, you know, when he was about 13, I think it was, left his family and his parents to kind of join a French academy. And then kind of went to Lille and worked there under Marcelo Bielsa, and then eventually got plucked by Brighton, basically. But he was great. You know, he was really good, obviously, about Postecoglou. And he kind of told this story about, because I think Postecoglou had referred to it before, about how, you know, he told Bissouma that he could be one of the leaders in the team. And then, you know, the next day, Bissouma was late for training. And Postecoglou kind of said, you know, if you want to be a leader, then you've got to be on time, kind of thing. And Bissouma sort of presented the other side of this anecdote, where he kind of said, I got stuck on the side of the road with a flat tire and there was traffic as well. I was a bit suspicious because I said to the Spurs media man afterwards, I kind of said, I feel like when you start giving more than one excuse, you start to sort of think that maybe, I don't know, it kind of felt like a sort of classic homework got eaten by the dog excuse. So I had a flat tire. Sorry, mate. But there was it was a nice story. And he talked a bit about Conte, you know, as well, because I think more than anyone else, you know, Bissouma personifies this transformation. You know, there's no player, I don't think, who was as bad last season and has been as good this season as Bissouma. And it was a bit like, you know, what happened there? And I, you know, players are always slightly guarded about this. You know, they don't want to be criticizing other managers particularly. And Bissouma was very dignified there. You know, he said, look, Conte's a great manager. But he did kind of say, whatever it was he was asking me to do, I basically wasn't doing it, you know. And he kind of said he has his ways in football and I have my ways, you know. And I think that just sort of spoke to the kind of disconnect between the two of them, that whatever Conte was asking Bissouma to do tactically, Bissouma either felt like he couldn't do or he didn't want to do. And he admitted that his confidence was incredibly low. I don't think I really had time to include this in the piece, but he kind of said this moment where, you know, at one moment I had to kind of say to myself, you know, I know who I am. I know what kind of football player I am and I know where I want to go. And you can just sort of, it felt like he was almost standing in the mirror kind of telling it to himself. And it was just kind of a moment where you think, yeah, footballers, they go through these periods where they really have to kind of remind themselves of their own egos and their own belief. And it was obviously an incredibly difficult season for Bissouma, but he is now thriving under a coach that believes in him and who's getting the best out of him.
Just on that, it's an interesting departure slightly for Bissouma there compared to pre-season. Now, first of all, Tom's interview was a planned sit-down interview as opposed to in the mix zone, which sounds a bit journalistic-y for the listeners. But just to give you an idea, sometimes, you know, players walk through after a game, speak for a couple of minutes, some don't want to do it, and they often won't go into that much detail. Whereas if you've got an arranged interview, there's more of an understanding that you'll talk for longer and maybe open up a bit more. But so there is that caveat. But in pre-season out in Perth, I think it was after the West Ham pre-season game, we got to speak to Bissouma, and that was where he started talking about Ange being like a dad or an uncle, which I see Mickey van der Ven speaking to Dan after the game at Arsenal also said the dad line, which is really interesting to see how many of the players are seeing him in that sort of father figure way. But back to Bissouma, that he said that, but we also did ask him, because it was an obvious question, you know, basically what happened last year. Can you open up a bit about it, like the way Tom has just managed to get him talking about it then? And he didn't want to talk about it at all. He just said, you know, that past is the past and I'm moving on from it now. So the fact that he is now opening up about it, perhaps after, you know, maybe he felt that he's actually put some performances in and some brilliant ones, whereas in pre-season, all he, you know, he hadn't yet. But that shows that maybe he is starting to be a bit more confident in his own skin, from a sort of a bit as a Spurs player point of view, and showing what he can do. So good to hear.
Yeah, I mean, I just get so excited when I see him on the ball. I mean, once he's got that ball, you don't get it off him. He just seems to shimmy past players from the tightest of spaces, and then he always distributes it well. I mean, he was absolutely magnificent. Now, look, we've sort of hinted that maybe there's a danger we're all getting a bit carried away so early into the season, which makes me think this next game against Liverpool is so important, because after that, and of course, it's very dangerous. And if we start talking Spursy again, you look at fixtures against Luton, Fulham and Crystal Palace. And while you consider that they could yield 9 points, you know what might happen. But should Spurs get a decent result this weekend and then do the business in the next three matches, I think we'll start to be entitled, maybe to feel that this is the beginning of something big. Dan, so, you know, from that point of view, Saturday for me, absolutely massive. And Liverpool obviously are unbeaten as well and have got a very good recent record against us.
Yeah, I mean, Tom Barkley made the point in our WhatsApp chat. I'll maybe let Tom jump in now and tell us what the stat was. But Conte made one of the strongest starts in Premier League history for Spurs last season, I think.
That is something I wanted to talk about. So our last season, and it's a little bit further on, actually, than where we're at now. But after they beat Everton 2-0, that was, I think, 10 Premier League games down. And it was the best start to a league season for Tottenham since 1963.
That, Tom, that is amazing. When we look back, and of course, it was a strange season because there was the big gap with the World Cup. And actually, if I'm not mistaken, the last game before the World Cup break was that thrilling win against Leeds. And I remember being... Now that you think about it, yeah, we were all pretty positive. Extraordinary what happened post the World Cup when you remind us of that stat.
It certainly was. But I think, well, I don't know if Dan was about to talk about this and we can sort of discuss it together, really. There's just a different feeling than last year. I'm literally got the results up in front of me now from the start of that season. And I think whilst it was exciting, the wins they were posting, the points they were posting, they weren't really playing that well. And the sense was like, oh, this could be something really to build on, an amazing start. And when they really kick into gear, just watch them go. But on reflection, that was about as good as it got. And they probably flattered to deceive. So it just feels a little bit different this year. It comes back to that theme that Postecoglou has said throughout this whole season. It doesn't really matter about nicking a 1-0. It's about building something fit to last. And I think the key difference to this year compared to last year is it feels like they're only just getting going and they can really build to something bigger and play much better than they are now. Whereas with obviously I'm sitting on Mount Hindsight right now, but looking back, it really did feel like the Spurs were showing the best that they had last season under Conte at that start. It wasn't like they were growing into something better. That was as good as it was going to get, and it all kind of went pear-shaped from there.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's important to say that in the back half of Conte's first season, I was really optimistic and excited about Spurs' future and what they could achieve under him. And I think when they beat Arsenal in that crucial game in May, I think they looked like the side under Conte who were best placed to go and, you know, potentially push Man City close the following season rather than Arsenal. And it, you know, should have been much better than it was. So it's not as if I was never enthused about what Spurs could do under Conte, because that's not the case at all. But as Tom says, it does just feel very different now compared to the start to last season. I think I remember saying several times, you know, it feels like Spurs are getting away with it and they've got a defeat in the post. And this team just passes the eye test much more convincingly than Conte's team at the start of last term, when they were really grinding out results and it felt like a defeat was inevitably coming. I remember everyone kind of optimistically wondering whether Spurs were sort of saving themselves for after the World Cup, which seems like a kind of mad narrative now, but that was very much what was being bandied around at the time. Whereas now, you know, you've got a team that is impressing every week, is exciting to watch, is kind of exhilarating. And, you know, the results are coming as well. And as Tom says, I think it does feel like they're just getting going, whereas it feels like Conte's side were kind of weirdly in this state of decline, which proved to be the case, but we weren't really sure why at the start of last season. And I just go back to what I said at the top of the pod. Again, you know, just listening to the players and indeed listening to Postecoglou, it really feels like something is building now. You know, everyone's very much on the same page. Everyone is so excited and enthusiastic by what's happening in the club. And again, that wasn't the case last year. I think the cracks were already kind of beginning to surface, and the rhetoric coming out of the camp was much more measured than it is now, where you've got a group of players who, you know, just have clearly kind of bought into the manager's methods much more quickly than even he, I think, expected. The one note of caution I would sound, if we're talking about whether we're getting carried away or not, is squad depth. You know, I've done a piece on it today. I think everyone knows it. We don't need to go over it too much. But, you know, clearly, if Spurs lose a couple of players from the spine of the team in particular, you know, one of the centre-halves, Maddison or Bissouma, Son, the goalkeeper, then I think suddenly, you know, it would become very, very difficult to sort of play Postecoglou's way as effectively. So I think in order for this to continue kind of at the same pace it is at the moment, they need to probably be lucky with injuries. But, you know, other than that, I think, as Postecoglou said, everyone has every right to kind of get really enthusiastic, and fans kind of should dream, because I think, you know, the potential of the club under him, if they really back him, is pretty limitless at the moment.
Yeah, and how refreshing as well to hear a manager say that. Come on, believe we can do something. We were effectively told, weren't we, by Antonio Conte on a regular basis that no, it'd be a miracle if we get in the top four. And I sort of understand that kidology too. But yeah, everything that, and we've said this, you know, ad nauseum, but everything Postecoglou says just hits the right note. And it's, I mean, honestly, it's an absolute joy. And I sincerely hope that, and I don't think we are going to be let down. I don't think this is another false dawn. I do think this game against Liverpool is going to be really interesting. But the other thing, and we have said this before, even if we were to lose it, and had we lost at Arsenal, as long as we keep playing the right way, and clearly we're going to do that because we did it at Arsenal. And Van de Ven, I don't know if it was in your interview, Dan, or somebody else that he was speaking to, but, you know, he was saying how he just loves playing for a manager who will not castigate him if occasionally a slight risk he takes goes wrong. And that gives him the confidence to play it the Tottenham way. And, you know, that's what makes this so exciting, and long may it continue. I mean, I'm going to have to shoot off soon, guys, because I'm actually watching former Spurs superstar Gareth Bale out here in Rome. He's playing in the All-Star Ryder Cup match with Colin Montgomery. And as we all know, Gareth Bale's actually taken his golf more seriously than his football over the past few years. He's up against Corey Pavin and Andrei Shevchenko. So we've got a real footballing battle going on out there. And interestingly, Novak Djokovic, the world number one tennis player, he's clearly never going to be the world's number one golfer. I think he plays off about 16. Brave, really, to go out in such rarefied company and show what you can or can't do.
How good is Gareth Bale at golf? Because I often see him sort of on these tours and playing these tournaments, but sometimes when is he kind of getting a special invite and when is he not? I mean, and how could he actually be a pro?
He's good. I mean, he did play, you're right, he played a PGA Tour event, or maybe two of them recently. I think these guys realise then when they do that you may be very, very good, but you have got to be truly outstanding. But I mean, he's playing off, I think, scratch, close to scratch. I've only got a score board that's showing me who's winning in a match play scenario rather than what he's actually shooting individually. But he just looks the part. whereas Djokovic was practicing the bunker before he went out, and it was interesting.
When Bale was at Spurs, he was kind of harbouring ambitions and telling a few people that he wanted to have a crack at being a pro golfer. I remember hearing that and thinking I was onto the story of a lifetime, but obviously it hasn't quite worked out.
No, well, I'm about to go out and just watch his last couple of holes, but I know we've briefly got to touch on Daniel Levy and, you know, further suggestions that he might be prepared to sell his stake. I think we want to have a quick word about Pochettino too. But if I have to duck off during that, are you, Dan, in the mood for giving another prediction after your successful call of the Arsenal game with regards to Liverpool?
I'm well into predictions now.
I thought you might be, mate. Yeah. So, okay, quickly, what do we all think about Liverpool on Saturday?
So I think Spurs are long overdue a win over Liverpool. I had a look today at the stats, actually, and I did not realise how horrendous it's been against them for so long. Spurs have won once in the last 23 meetings, including the Champions League final, which is really quite astonishing given the clubs haven't been particularly far apart in that time. You know, I know Liverpool since about 2018 have kind of moved ahead of Spurs, but there's not been much in it for a while. So I think Spurs are overdue one. I think the atmosphere at home is immense at the moment. I think the crowd will be right behind them. Obviously, a certain amount depends on Maddison fitness, which we don't know about as we speak now and as we're recording. But I'm going to go 2-1 Spurs.
I don't know. I sort of think it might be a draw. I don't know if that's optimistic or pessimistic. I think that Liverpool...
We know you're a pessimist now. It's fine. Just own it.
I think Liverpool are probably the form team in the league at the moment, apart from Manchester City. You know, it looks to me like they are the side who, at this early stage, you might say will be sort of City's closest, in inverted commas, challengers. Salah seems to be back in form. Darwin Nunez maybe just kind of picking up and finding some momentum as well. So I think this is a really tough match, arguably, perhaps as an opponent, even tougher than Arsenal, although at home, obviously. So I don't know. I think it could be another, maybe a 1-1, that kind of thing, which I think would be a pretty good result for Spurs.
I quite fancy Tottenham. I know I did last week and it didn't happen, but it wasn't far away. And I've watched a bit of Liverpool this season and I feel like their results are very, very good, but I think they can be got at defensively. I think Alisson has pulled them out, saved them a few times. That Newcastle result, I don't know how Newcastle did not win that game and how Liverpool turned it around. It was two clinical finishes from Nunez, Newcastle missing a bunch of chances. But I think Alisson was pretty good against West Ham again at the weekend. Wolves, they fell behind. I just quite fancy the way Spurs play to score maybe even a couple of goals. You're right, though. Obviously, Salah is banging form. It's quite hard to tell what their starting lineup's going to be. They've got so many options now, Liverpool, all over the place. That's going to be hard to prepare for. But I think this Spurs momentum and the good feeling that will be in the ground, particularly after last week, might take them on to the next level. So I'm going to say 3-2 Tottenham.
Ooh, okay. Let me tell you that Novak Djokovic may have just killed about five people. He's hit a ball straight into the crowd. They weren't expecting it. Gareth Bale, by contrast, has played the most delightful shot onto the third green. I reckon it's going to be another 2-2 draw. I tend to be pessimistic about these things. It's a great stat, Dan. I hadn't realised it was only one win in 23, because prior to that, actually, we had a really good run of results against them. But they have become something of a bogey team for us. But I think particularly under Conte, and I got a good friend who's a Liverpool fan, and he always said, you guys just play it the wrong way against us. And obviously, I think we'll play it the right way against them. So, yeah, I can see a draw and another really entertaining match. And then that could set us up for those three winnable games against Luton, Crystal Palace and Fulham. Guys, I'm very sorry that I'll have to leave you at this stage. See you later, guys.
Well, thanks, Marcus. Yeah, I will step into the breach for the final 10 minutes or so of the podcast. I think we're going to have a quick look at Poch. But let's talk about those Levy comments last week to Bloomberg, in which he said he was open to anything. He was asked if he would sell a stake in Spurs. To me, they felt significant because Levy rarely does interviews. When he does interviews, there's often a reason. And it just felt like, given the platform and, you know, given the timing, it was a almost open-arm plea to investors, you know, a come-and-get-me plea, if you like, to a potential minority investor to come and pump some money into the club. That was my reading of it. And I know from having spoken to people over the last year or so that there was a feeling that Levy wasn't sure whether he wanted to sell a minority stake or a majority stake. And, you know, perhaps he's made up his mind that, you know, he wants to stay in charge. He wants to and stay in control, but he wouldn't mind some money being pumped in from somewhere. And, you know, that strikes me as maybe a decent solution for Spurs, allowing them to, you know, compete financially with some of their rivals, some of the state-backed and, you know, richer clubs in the league, while, you know, Levy staying at the helm. I mean, what did you guys make of them?
Yeah, I think that would be not too outlandish in that assessment. I think he specifically said he didn't want to leave. So I think it's fair for us to infer that he'd probably be more open to, as you say, selling a minority stake rather than a full takeover. And the fact that, for example, the Qatari sports investments were looking at it last January and basically was too expensive is generally what the feeling was, and walked away and moved on to other investment opportunities, suggests that they weren't really open to wanting to sell it unless they got this sort of astronomical offer. I mean, I haven't been covering the club as long as you, anywhere near as long as you have. So it wasn't like I saw him speaking on Bloomberg and instantly thought, oh, why is he doing this now? He doesn't normally do this. There must be something up with it. But listening to you speak about it makes me think, oh, I guess there is actually some relevance in that. So it's not to say that there's definitely something in the pipeline, but if it was to be, then it wouldn't be a surprise, would it?
Well, the club said, I also think, Levy owed an interview to Bloomberg. It was an historic arrangement that he was honouring, presumably because he was having a week of talking and he did the fan forum the day before, I think. So that was the kind of steer from the club, but you know, it still struck me as significant, you know, given it's the biggest business channel in the world, and given Levy, as I said, kind of effectively appealed for investment.
I also think, like, if you think about the last kind of 6 months or the last year or so, I mean, Daniel Levy wouldn't be human if he didn't kind of get to this point and think, blimey, like, this has been, you know, a pretty challenging few months. And I mean, you know, we know all the things, you know, Conte, Paratici, the Stellini episode, Joe Lewis, Harry Kane, obviously. And then you've got all the protests as well that have been going on, you know, pretty regularly throughout that time. Yeah, I mean, it's going well now. But I do wonder if, you know, a few months ago when it was really in the heat of the kind of Stellini kind of period, I guess, whether he thought, blimey, when we kind of come through this, maybe this is the right time for me to step aside. It's possible, I guess. And I completely agree with Dan that whenever Daniel Levy speaks in any way, you know, publicly, it surely means something. In the fact that he spoke at all, and the fact that he spoke to Bloomberg, I think is definitely worth noting.
Pochettino, I think we're going to enjoy some schadenfreude here, perhaps. But I think it's worth talking about him purely for me, because I certainly expected Pochettino's presence at Chelsea to perhaps be a hindrance to Postecoglou and put a little bit of pressure on him, you know, having a celebrated former manager up the road who Spurs and Levy ignored over the summer despite his interest in coming back. You know, wouldn't necessarily be helpful for Postecoglou. He'd be a kind of constant reminder of what Spurs had and could have had again. And that's assuming, I think, Postecoglou had a difficult start, which most of us were expecting back in the summer, and that Pochettino, you know, had a relatively decent start, which again, I think didn't seem unreasonable given that Chelsea, you know, had done a lot of their business already last season. But, you know, weirdly, it's kind of worked in the opposite way. And, you know, I wrote a column on Pochettino and Chelsea today ahead of their game at Brighton, which I think is obviously an interesting game given how much they've raided Brighton over the last 18 months. And I mentioned at the bottom that Postecoglou's fast start is, I think, adding pressure to Pochettino. I've certainly seen Chelsea fans on social media point out that Postecoglou's quickly got results and implemented a style with a mostly new team and a lot of young players, which obviously Pochettino is kind of struggling to do at Chelsea. Having said that, I think he's got all the ingredients to be a success there. You know, he's the right man for the job. They've got a really tough stretch, Tom, coming up in the next 9 games. Do you think it's going to take a kind of show of patience and nerve from the owners to sort of keep the faith with him? You know, do you think he deserves to be under pressure?
I don't know. I think he will be under pressure, you know, but not to kind of go into too much detail about the whole Chelsea situation. Because, I mean, I agree with you, Dan, completely that it feels like Chelsea fans are now the ones who are kind of having to deal with the kind of Postecoglou effect in the way that Spurs are playing, how quickly that they've managed to kind of transform a young team. They're kind of saying, well, why do we have to wait for months and months, you know? And I guess when I remember when we were talking about, you know, the sort of long list of possible Spurs managers, weren't we? And we kind of had a pod, I can't remember when it was, must have been sort of April, May sort of time, you know, who should be the next manager. And we should probably confess that we all, I think, said that the first choice, in our opinion, should be Pochettino. And I don't know if this kind of month at Chelsea changes our minds on that, you know. And I guess, you know, for sure the first month of Postecoglou means that he's so far been a great appointment. I don't think Pochettino has become a terrible manager overnight. You know, I see some people kind of rewriting the Pochettino history and saying, well, maybe he's just not a top coach. Maybe he never was. Maybe he only, you know, belongs in kind of, you know, the sort of mid-range clubs and, you know, isn't good enough to kind of manage the sort of European elite. I don't think that, but I do think there's a misfit there. I never really believed there was a connection between the Chelsea thing and the Pochettino thing. And I was surprised he walked out of one mess of a club and into another one. And I wonder if he's already having some regrets. I sort of look on it a little bit with sadness, I guess, because, you know, I think the Pochettino effect at Spurs was obviously so, so historic and fantastic that to see his kind of reputation being besmirched like this, I think is a little bit disappointing.
When we said we wanted Pochettino back then, I have to say a lot of it was because of the romantic idea of him coming back. What a story that would have been. But I look at Chelsea, and even with the way Postecoglou has turned Tottenham around so quickly, I don't know if there'll be many managers who could go in there and have a similar effect there. There are so many things up against them, and they've just done so many things wrong, I think. I just don't understand why they're giving players massively long contracts. I get the plan is to try and get around FFP doing it, but I really worry sort of from a motivational point of view why you would do that. They're signing all these younger players and they don't seem to get that it's about having a blend in your squads. I mean, I was at Brighton's press conference on Tuesday and I asked Roberto De Zerbi specifically about that, because whilst Brighton are known for playing all these great young players and bringing them on before selling them to Chelsea most of the time, they also realise that there's a lot of value in having older heads help develop those players. And that's why they've brought in the likes of Lallana and Welbeck and Milner on free transfers. But Chelsea don't do that. Apparently they've had this policy of 25 and younger. I just don't think that's a good idea. They're putting too much faith in players who are not used to the league, like Mudryk, like Nicholas Jackson. They don't seem to have signed a centre forward apart from Jackson, where clearly that was a massive issue. Then Pochettino is not completely immune to any of this. Jackson is a good point, a good case in point. I mean, the guy's got 5 yellow cards for dissent in 5 matches in the Premier League. I obviously you put that mainly down to the player, but I feel like the manager needs to take some responsibility for that. You can't be having players do that in games as regularly as that's happened. And then interesting to read his quotes today, talking about confidence, which obviously is what Chelsea are struggling with at the moment. And he said, you know, confidence, we cannot buy it in the supermarket, it's about time, with obvious reference to the amount of money they've spent. And yeah, I can't disagree with that at all. It's just whether he will get that time. And I just didn't realise that the situation at Chelsea was as bad as it was, you know, statistically. When Graham Potter took over, he had a good start and then he got thumped at his old club Brighton 4-1. And ever since then, they've taken 28 points from 33 league games. I mean, I really didn't realise it was quite as bad. I clearly haven't been paying enough attention, but that is relegation form. And I don't really know what the best hopes are for Chelsea, even at this early stage. Maybe the League Cup, they play Brighton later tonight. Need to go all out for that, really. But after that, I just think it's such a difficult situation for any manager. And even Postecoglou, with the way he's come in at Spurs, I don't think he could have had a similar effect at Chelsea. So even though I don't think Pochettino is not without criticism, I think it's more the culture at the club that Todd Boehly has engendered rather than specifically Mauricio.
I mean, you look at that match in early November now, Spurs at home to Chelsea, which is what, in 4 or 5 games' time? Like, it's very not impossible that Pochettino will be under real pressure at that moment, you know, and I don't know, narrative alert that possibly, you know, Spurs being responsible for the final nail in the coffin of the Pochettino Chelsea era.
Yeah, again, on that, I mean, I remember looking at the fixture list and talking to our colleague George Sessions, and he was saying it would be easy to imagine Postecoglou having a very difficult start, being under a bit of pressure himself, and then beating Pochettino to kind of turn everything round. Because I think that, again, that was what we were all expecting. But as you say, Tom, you know, it could be the reverse. It could be Pochettino going to that game under huge pressure and Postecoglou looking to kind of pile it on him. But look, you know what? I'm happy to say that, you know, I was wrong. And I will hold my hands up because I really wanted Pochettino to come back. I thought he would be, you know, thought he should be the number one choice. And I was, you know, hoping Levy would swallow his pride and pick up the phone, frankly. But I think this first month, and this is nothing to do with how Pochettino's done at Chelsea, but this kind of first six games under Postecoglou has kind of convinced me that Spurs absolutely have the right manager. You know, how much credit Levy deserves from that, you know, we can debate and have done on previous pods. But I think he does deserve praise for resisting the temptation and the pressure to go back to Poch. I think you can feel the kind of freshness and the newness about Spurs. And I think that's probably what they needed. And I do think, you know, again, with the benefit of hindsight, Poch coming back in, there might have been, you know, a lot of baggage there and you know, kind of hangovers that were a little bit unwelcome. And given how bleak the kind of period since his sacking has been, I think a totally clean slate and a totally fresh start is pretty beneficial for everyone. And we're kind of seeing that on the pitch.
Did you think of the velvet double-breasted jacket?
Is that what Pochettino's been wearing?
Have you not seen? I think I've had this thing in my head now for a while that just Pochettino is not the same Pochettino that he was 10 years ago. And I can't decide if that's just because he's at Chelsea and that's kind of, you know, turning him to something that he's not, or whether he is a different manager, you know, and this kind of really reinforced it for me. Like, you know, if you remember Pochettino at Spurs, he was always kind of wearing these sort of really like slick sort of Spursy tracksuits and he just looked very kind of young and fresh. And now he just sort of looks a bit more, I don't know, crusty and sort of, and that jacket just kind of really nailed it home for me.
I think that was always the argument, you know, over whether he should come back to Spurs. You know, you are not hiring the Pochettino of 2014. You are hiring the Pochettino of 2023. And, you know, inevitably he's older, perhaps he's a bit more cynical, you know, perhaps the, you know, fires have dampened a little bit. But that's not to say, you know, he's not more experienced, he's not managed bigger players, he's won things. So, you know, there's pros and cons, but I definitely think, you know, he's a different manager. And I think the club made a call ultimately that they needed a manager, irrespective of age, who was more like Pochettino in 2014 than Pochettino in 2023. And, you know, Postecoglou feels like that. You know, he feels on the way up. He feels kind of hungry, like the fires are kind of burning at full capacity. I think you can make a case that that's arguably not the case for Pochettino anymore. Before we go, I mean, we've done about 10 minutes on Chelsea there, almost became a Chelsea pod briefly, but let's go back to Spurs-Liverpool. We've done our predictions. Is there anything else from the game that, you know, you think could be sort of particularly noteworthy or intriguing? I mean, we've touched on the front three. I mean, I wondered about the kind of midfield battle. Liverpool have a whole kind of new look midfield. So do Spurs, in a sense. Another sort of big test for Sarr and Bissouma, but I feel kind of strangely confident that they can kind of come out on top of that one.
Yeah, I mean, there's nothing that I haven't seen so far this season to not give me confidence from Spurs' point of view that they can take on anyone. Just the way that they're trying to play their own game. As Ange said in the lead up to the Arsenal game, he's not really bothered about what, in that context, what Arsenal were doing, but what any other team is doing. He wants to focus on what his team can do. And the sort of key to that is the midfield and the two centre-backs sort of starting off attacks and the little triangles the likes of Bissouma and Sarr and Maddison play. As you said earlier, it's going to be critical that Maddison is fit for this game for Spurs' chances. I'm also intrigued to see if, I'm not sure what's the latest on Trent Alexander-Arnold, whether he's going to make it back for this game, and whether, I don't know whether if he does play, he's obviously so good going forward. And Gomez, unfortunately, because of his injuries, is sort of a bit of a shadow of what he used to be. So I guess Trent being out would be a boost for Spurs. But I don't know if he's on the right. I know he's coming into midfield now with the way he plays. With the way Destiny Udogie's been playing, I think that could be an area they could really try to exploit. And I know that might sound a bit sort of a kind of old take to say, oh, let's go and exploit Trent down the right for Liverpool. But I kind of mean with the way Spurs have are setting up now with their particular fullbacks and Udogie particularly at home playing so far forward and so central, that could be a real area where Spurs could get a lot of joy. But it does also seem absolutely critical how they deal with Salah. It's always been a problem for Spurs over the years, as it has been for most teams. And he's just so hot at the moment that it'll be a real test for, I guess he'll be coming up against Destiny as well. I mean, that's, again, that's another big test for him. But personally, I'm not sure I'd swap him for anyone else in the Premier League at left back right now. And I'd back him to continue his great form.
Yeah, I think that Udogie against Salah thing is a real crucial part of the match. And I actually think him playing against Saka like the week before should hopefully, you know, help him. I think, you know, he really came through that match pretty well in the end, you know, after a few bumps along the way, and came out of it with a lot of credit against, you know, one of the best players in the league in that position. And I think, you know, having that just before playing against Salah, he'll go into it not just with kind of more confidence, but also I think with a bit more knowledge and experience of how to handle that kind of player. And I think also it's a big test for the kind of Van de Ven-Romero partnership. I mean, this was the game last season, wasn't it, where Dyer kind of made that bad error, which, you know, allowed Salah to go in and score. And Van de Ven, I thought, was, you know, one of the kind of less, you know, heralded, but played really well against Arsenal. Some brilliant tackles, really marshalled Jesus, I thought, really well. And I think if he can kind of come through these two games with his credit still intact, then Spurs will be in a great place for the rest of the season.
Yeah, agreed. I think it's going to be another really intriguing game. And I, just as a wider point to finish on, do look at Liverpool as a kind of interesting model, really, for what can be achieved by Spurs. I know Ange said last week that he doesn't want to follow anyone else's blueprint, but, you know, you get in a top coach, you use data cleverly to get recruitment right, back them to build a top squad, and look what's achievable even without state backing or a kind of oligarch in charge. I think there are a really encouraging kind of blueprint for Postecoglou's Tottenham to potentially follow. But maybe we'll go into that in more detail in a future pod. We'll certainly be back after the game this weekend with a reaction pod and then around for a kind of fuller chat next week. But from me, Dan Kilpatrick, thank you. From Tom Allnut and Tom Barkley, thank you. And from Marcus, who has disappeared to watch Gareth Bale and Novak Djokovic, goodbye as well. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next week.